amigos y bienvenidos a este vuestro programa Dos Gatos en Tierra de Perros. Un podcast de actualidad donde analizamos de manera fáctica y neutral las noticias más relevantes de la política y cultura norteamericana.
Hello, I'm Joe Magaja. Thank you, friends, for being with me for another episode of Dos Gatos en Tierra de Perros. Today, I have with me journalist Thomas Fazi from Italy. Welcome, Thomas.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. It's early morning there and evening here in California. A lot of crazy things are happening in the world right now. The most recent thing, the news that came out, at least in the United States, was that Biden has authorized long-distance missiles to be sent from Ukraine into Russian territory. Has there been much response in Europe over this, or what are the thoughts, and what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I think it's utterly insane. That's my that's my analysis in a nutshell. It's shocking on so many levels. It's shocking that a president who's just been voted out, who should simply sort of guide the transition to the new presidency, would take such a momentous decision. Would take any major foreign policy decision. That in itself would be completely out of place. It would be completely a violation of protocol. At this point, what Biden should be doing, to the extent that he's capable of actually doing anything, he should simply be, a caretaker, allowing for a smooth transition. So the fact that he would take any foreign policy decision is in itself quite surprising. The fact that we take a decision like this, which essentially amounts to the US and by extension NATO declaring war on Russia. Putin has been very, very clear about this. 2 months ago, he said, if the US or NATO more in general allow Ukraine to use Western long-range missiles to strike on Russia, that will amount to the NATO's direct entry into this war. And he explained why. He said, these missiles, they can't be operated without Western satellites. Satellites in the European Union, satellites or American satellites. And they can't be manned without NATO personnel. He made it very clear that this would amount to crossing the line from a, quote unquote, proxy war between NATO and Russia, which has, of course, been ongoing for the past 3 years, to a direct war, because it would literally be NATO firing directly onto Russia, which is the reason why, so far, even our reckless leaders in the West have refrained from authorizing such a use. So Biden's decision really, crosses a huge red line. Again, from Russia's standpoint, this amounts to us directly entering the war with Russia. And, Putin also made it very clear. Russia changed its nuclear doctrine recently, saying that it now would consider even a conventional attack by a country supported by a nuclear armed country, i.e., several NATO countries, tantamount to a direct attack by that country, possibly warranting a nuclear response. So we've entered really into completely terrifying territory, really. And it's really hard to it's hard to gauge what's going on in these people's minds, to be honest. When I say it's madness, I think there is an element, there truly is an element of madness. There aren't many ways of reading this. either the Western foreign policy establishment and the NATO establishment is totally convinced that Russia will never retaliate, regardless of what we do to Russia, which is, of course, an absurd premise. Why would you believe that? I think Russia has made it pretty clear that there are certain red lines that it won't allow the West to cross. And of course, bringing NATO, bringing Ukraine into NATO, even if just de facto, which is what we've been doing since 2014, was one of those red lines to which Putin clearly reacted to in 2022. So when we know that he has a history of reacting to red lines being crossed, why would you believe that he wouldn't react to such a massive red line as essentially, you know, firing missiles potentially anywhere across Russia, including Moscow? Why would you think he wouldn't react to that as any country would? By the way, I mean, the equivalent would be, Russia-backed forces in Mexico or Canada firing, you know, just free firing missiles across the United States and potentially even in Washington. And by the way, I mean, this is already happening. It has been happening for some time on a minor scale through the use of drones. But, you know, this wouldn't be the first time that Ukraine, backed by NATO, has attacked even quite deep inside Russia. In fact, not to mention has committed several terrorist attacks.
Dugina. Daughter, and the yeah. There was a journalist that was murdered in a coffee house as well.
Right. Yeah, I remember we got video of that, haven't we? Yes, that was. Yeah. So this wouldn't be the first time, but of course this would be this, as Putin said again, completely changes the nature and the essence of this conflict. So, you know, we're really wading into uncharted territory here. And, you know, I think it's high time that people in the West, really, and especially in Europe, start speaking up against this madness. We know that an element that makes this decision even more insane is that we know, well, we clearly know from the recent U.S. elections that the U.S., voters don't want war with Russia. I mean, there are several, of course, factors for the results of the election and Trump's victory. But I think it's pretty clear, even from polls that we've seen, that foreign policy was a big issue in the elections, and that one of the reasons, and the only reason, one of the reasons why people voted for Trump was also because they were tired of Biden's reckless proxy war in against Russia in Ukraine. So this is also a clear violation of any kind of basic democratic principle. You're escalating a war that citizens have just voted against de facto. And whenever in all the recent elections that we've had in Europe, we've also seen anti-war parties on the rise, most notably in Germany, in the recent elections in East Germany, which where we've got two parties, the sort of far-right AfD and a kind of left populist Starer Wagenknecht party, which together have a majority, and they've both been quite outspoken about the war. And polls in Germany and other countries show that we now have a solid majority, I would say, in most, if not all, Western European countries against this absurd proxy war. This chap adds just one other level of insanity to this whole thing. I mean, we're risking nuclear war against a country that poses no threat whatsoever to Europe or the United States in a war that most people want to see end. So it's really insane on so many levels, and I'm just at a loss to even try to understand it. But I think it's completely crazy. And it clearly is a way of sabotaging Trump's stated goal of bringing war.
Yes, exactly. I think it was possibly planned out in advance to sabotage, so that, I mean, because if he has to start his presidency in a war as it's escalating, that definitely would be difficult for him and for his cabinet, and it would probably ensure possibly that he won't get he wouldn't get another term, because this is his second term, but there would be a successor, possibly his vice president. I have also heard that they're actually preparing troops in Germany to possibly fight in Ukraine. Is anything like that happening in Italy?
No. For the moment, I mean, it's not something that's seriously being taken into consideration. The Italian government is part of the proxy war efforts. So we've been sending money and equipment to Ukraine. So we've been towing the NATO line quite diligently. But at the same time, the government is aware that especially in Italy, there is very, very little support for this. Italy is a country that has strong cultural and historical ties with Russia, for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that for a very long time, Italy had the biggest communist party in the West, which meant that, almost half the country, which identified as communist, obviously looked upon Russia as a positive model. And for a very long time, we also had extensive, political and even economic relations with the Soviet Union. Not to mention the kind of basic cultural ties that I would say all Western Europeans have with Russia. So it's not just that this is not just an Italian thing, but in Italy, because of the just the role played by the Communist Party for most of the post-war period, the ties are especially strong, and so there's no support whatsoever for waging war on Russia, as much as they've tried, of course, like elsewhere, to strike into people's minds and hearts, or to engineer a fear of Russia, a fear of Putin. It really hasn't worked. The propaganda, it's worked on, of course, a minority of the population, I would say, but most people can see through that. So I think it would be very, very hard for the government to be able to justify the actual deployment of troops in a war against Russia. Not to mention the fact that Italy is one big U.S. military base presence in Italy. Some of America's most important bases are in Italy. We have the headquarters of the Sixth Fleet in Naples. We've got Camp Darby, which is one of the biggest American military bases in Europe. We've got the Air Force Base at Aviano up north, which hosts U.S. nuclear weapons. One of the biggest, if not the most important, U.S. drone base in the Mediterranean. And so we would, Italy would be a massive target in eventuality of a direct conflict with Russia, and that's something that a lot of Italians are also aware about, which makes them particularly wary about the idea of going to war with Russia. Honestly, I mean, the simple fact that we're sitting here discussing this as a possibility is just utterly insane, because it's clear to anyone that this would be, for Europe, maybe not necessarily for the US, but for Europe, this would be utterly catastrophic. And even if this was just limited to a conventional war, so even if we exclude the end game scenario of an actual nuclear exchange, which would of course kill most people in Europe, even though it is something that we cannot exclude. And part of the madness is thinking that thinking that you can just take nuclear weapons out of this equation, which is an inversion of the Cold War approach to nuclear weapons, where everyone took the issue very seriously. Now somehow we've entered this new cognitive territory in the West where we think that no country would ever use nuclear weapons, or at least our enemies would not use nuclear weapons. So we don't have to worry about that, which is a truly different form of mad to do a play on words. But so that's the situation in Italy, but it's not that different in other Western European countries, to be honest. As I said, there's very little support for this in Germany as well. Honestly, I don't think, but I'm not speaking out of direct knowledge, but I mean, I can't imagine Germany's soldiers to be that well fit or well trained, honestly. And the idea that there's a sufficient amount of well trained German soldiers that could be deployed in an actual conventional war against Russia, I think is completely delusional. But it is true that West European leaders at the moment do seem bent on continuing this war, which is, you know, again, crazy on another level, to the extent that one might argue that, at least from an American perspective, there's a certain geographic distance between at least Ukraine and the US, might allow for some for a level of cognitive bias, you know, on the level of on behalf of US leaders, and even just US citizens more in general, in a sense that this is such a faraway conflict for them that you can see why, even though that would be a mistake clearly, but you can see why they would think that this is not a direct threat to them. But Europe shares a huge border with Russia. So while the whole affair of the proxy war in Ukraine is somewhat understandable on a psychological and even on a strategic level from a US standpoint, it makes really no sense whatsoever from a European standpoint. So for Europe to have allowed itself to be dragged into this this proxy war really something that I think future historians will be scratching their heads over quite a bit, just how this was possible, because clearly it goes against Europe's basic strategic interests on every level, on an economic, on a security standpoint, on a military standpoint. It really makes no sense whatsoever. But here we are. Here we are in a situation where we see European leaders now actually afraid that Trump might bring this war to an end. So, we've got a complete, inversion of logic. Any normal person would rejoice in Europe, at the prospect of the end of this war, but not our leaders. There's nothing that terrifies them more at this point.
Right. Well, I've talked to some people in Spain about this as well. And I mean, it seems like the European Union and NATO, which kind of go hand in hand to a certain extent, it's an experiment that in a lot of ways has failed, particularly for countries in the South, such as Italy, Spain, Greece, because it didn't end up bringing prosperity to these countries like was expected, and now you're on the brink of war. I'm not really sure what to think about Meloni. I know she has a lot of things that she says that are not they're sort of just conservative about the family and that kind of thing, but then shortly before Kissinger died, she took a bunch of pictures with him, and he's about the biggest war hawk you could ever imagine. So I'm not sure where she lies. Von der Leyen clearly is 100% in for, destroying the world, it seems like, What are your thoughts there? And do you think that the European Union will continue to stay whole, or that others might drop out like the UK did?
It's pretty clear to me that the European Union is one of the biggest political and institutional failures in modern history. It's been an absolute disaster from an economic standpoint. It's been an absolute disaster from the standpoint of the health of our democratic life. And now it's proving to be an absolute disaster from a geopolitical standpoint. So it's a project that has failed on every level. It's a project that has failed to attain any of its stated goals. This is particularly obviously in the economic realm, especially the euro, the single currency. Has trees, especially the early joiners. My country is a prime example of that. A country that has been absolutely that has really only suffered from joining the single currency. But there are several other examples. You know, Greece, Spain, and several southern European countries that really. Should not have joined. The euro was a very bad project to begin with. The idea of taking several countries with different, very heterogeneous economic models and development models, and just cultural approaches to economic life, and lumping them together into one union was always a bad idea, which is why several economists have warned against that. And it proved out to be just that. It's a project that has really increased economic divergences within Europe. So instead of promoting economic harmonization, economic convergence has promoted divergence by every economic account, by every economic metric. So really a complete another failure, and that's not even getting into the more political democratic aspect of it, and that is the way in which the euro has been used, and the European Union more in general has been used to really hollow out democracy in Europe, because once you start transferring sovereign powers and sovereign tools of economic intervention from the nation state, from the national level, which is subject to some degree of democratic control and accountability, to the supranational level, which is undemocratic, I would say by definition, because we don't have any successful example of nation states coming together and building a supranational democracy. That's never existed, and the European Union is there to attest to the fact that it really can't happen, even if you might have the formal structures in place, which we don't even have in the European Union, by the way. But even if we did, it wouldn't be a real democracy. So really, this process of European integration, was ultimately a way of insulating the decision-making process from the masses, from the people, by concentrating power and control in the hands of these institutions, which really are insulated from any form of meaningful democratic control. Today, the real sort of kingmaker in the Eurozone is the European Central Bank. It's the central bank is the most powerful institution in the Eurozone, and it's it acts as a sovereign power which has really the power and death over entire countries, over entire governments, and is subject to any form of democratic control whatsoever. You can't vote out the ECB, and you're subject to the European Central Banks as a country, as a nation. You're subject to its decisions and to its policies, and you can vote in whoever you want at the national level, but that won't really make much of a difference, because the governments in the Eurozone have really been deprived of all the meaning of all the basic meaningful tools of economic policy, which means that they don't have the means to implement one form of economic policy over another. Because in order to manage the economy, you need the basic tools of economic policy. You need to control the monetary policy, the exchange rate policy, the fiscal policy. All those tools have been delegated to the European Union now. So we've really entered a kind of, profoundly post-democratic phase in European history. I mean, I wouldn't even consider really the countries. European Union is one thing in the sense that you can be in a European Union but still control your currency, as say Hungary and other countries do. You still have a kind of relative form of sovereignty, even though you're still subject to several constraints simply by being a part of the European Union. But being a part of the Eurozone, I think, really brings you into a completely post-democratic territory, because you've given up the basic plank of economic sovereignty, which is monetary sovereignty. And if you don't have any economic, if the state in which you live, if the country in which you you vote doesn't have any economic sovereignty, then you're not really sovereign either. There is no popular sovereignty, because you really won't be able to choose between different models of government, different models of economic policy. And that's where we're at now. And that, I think, partly explains your question about Meloni too. I could tell you a lot about where Meloni comes from, and the fact that, you know, she belongs to the kind of Atlanticist hard right in Italy. So she's always been pro-American. She's had relations with the Aspen Institute for a very long time. So contrary to what you would expect from a post-fascist, you would expect that, you know, a post-fascist or someone that looks upon that period with nostalgia to be, an anti-American, since they were the ones that ultimately defeated fascism. But in fact, there were two important sort of currents in the post-fascist right in Italy, a more, anti-American, and you could even say pro-Russian one, and a more pro-American one. And Meloni belongs, as has belonged for a long time, to the Atlanticist hard right. So her foreign policy views are not completely a surprise, but really it's a moot point to the extent that Meloni isn't really in a condition to choose, to autonomously choose neither her economic policies nor her foreign policies, because Italy is not a sovereign country. It's not a sovereign country from an economic standpoint. And, we've learned that the hard way in Italy. We've been at the receiving end of, there's a lot of talk of foreign interference here in Europe these days, but I can't think of any institution that's interfered more in the democratic electoral process in Europe than the European Union itself. In 2011, the European Central Bank essentially engineered a financial crisis to get Berlusconi out of office, basically. And that's quite well accepted nowadays. Even during at the time of the formation of the 2018 kind of populist government between the League and the Five Star Movement, we also sort of saw the European Central Bank kind of ramp up interest rates as a way of keeping the heat on the government, and before that on the parties that were going on to create the government. So I think we've learned the hard way that Italy is not sovereign in any way, and that any government that tries to defy the EU's agenda will pay a very high price. And so Meloni understands that very well. I don't think it's a justification. I mean, I think that if you know that that's how things work, then you should, at the very least, be open about that and educate people about the constraints that you're facing. You shouldn't just play along, which is exactly what Meloni is doing, because you know that that's the only way to hang on to power. So Meloni doesn't really have much of a choice when it comes to the economic front. But as you mentioned, the European Union and NATO today are essentially the same thing. What we know, another very disturbing development that we've witnessed over the past few years is really this fusion between the European Union and NATO, to the extent that the European Union today can be considered sort of an extended arm of NATO and thus of the US from a kind of geostrategic standpoint. So we've really seen the European Union evolve into the exact opposite of what we were told the European Union was supposed to be. So even taking aside all the negative, impacts from an economic standpoint and in terms of democratic balance and so on and so forth, the one argument that maybe was left was that this would make that the European Union would make Europe geopolitically stronger. And of course, from a sort of commonsensical standpoint, it would seem to make sense, that if we all band together, that's going to make it stronger rather than every single country going its own way. I mean, that was an argument that, has long appealed to people's kind of reason and instinct, and because it does seem to make sense at face value. But of course, now we see the exact opposite. We see the European Union has not become a counterbalance to American power. The European Union has become, as I said, an extension of American power. And to the extent that today Europe is more vassalized to the US, is more subordinated politically, geopolitically, economically, psychologically to the US than I would say it's ever been since 1945. And that is largely a result related to the role played by the European Union, which is the ultimate paradox. This institution was supposed to, let us stand on our own two feet and not be, not have to look up to the American Big Brother anymore, has in fact turned us into, geopolitical midgets, which is, but of course, precisely because that is what the European Union is today, it also means that countries that are subject to the EU's sort of economic and political control would face consequences today, not just if they went up against the economic agenda of the European Union, but even if they went up against the foreign policy agenda of NATO. It's very likely that countries would be would find themselves at the receiving end of similar forms of financial and monetary blackmail, such as the ones that we've seen in the past, when countries tried to defy the EU's economic agenda, such as Greece in 2015, and another occasions. And I think we've seen that in Hungary.
Orban, exactly. It's been.
Yeah, we've seen Hungary been subject to, threatened with, and actually subjected to financial blackmail in the form of EU funds that are owed to Hungary being withheld under the guise of Hungary being in violation of whatever Brussels happens to define as being the rule of law. But in fact, it's pretty clear that one of the reasons why. Or at least one of the goals they've tried to achieve through this form of financial blackmail is to pressure Hungary to get in line when it comes to NATO and when it comes to the proxy war in Ukraine. Hungary is virtually the only country that has openly defied the EU's policy in Ukraine. And it's come under very, very intense pressure from not just from Washington, of course, but also from the European Union. But as I was saying, Hungary is lucky enough to have retained its currency when it joined the European Union, which means that there are limits to the extent of economic and financial pressure that the European Union can apply on Hungary, because, it can't engineer with a click an economic and financial crisis as it can do with regards to the countries that have the euro, because ultimately, by controlling the forint, by controlling its own currency, Hungary is largely, or can exercise a large degree of control over its economy. I'm pretty convinced that really this is the only reason why Orban has been able to survive so long, why they haven't been able to unseat him. I think if Hungary had been in the euro, Orban would have been removed in one way or another via some form of economic or financial or monetary pressure. So overall, yes, I think we can conclude that the European Union and especially the euro were very, very bad, very, very bad ideas. But at the same time today, unfortunately, there's kind of a near consensus that these institutions are unchallengeable, which is the most depressing part. At least 10 years ago or so, there was a wide range of parties, both on the right and on the left, that seriously questioned the viability of the European Union, and even advocated for some countries' exits from the Eurozone. That is no longer the case today. Even all the supposedly scary, nationalist far right or right populist parties have basically all accepted to work within the constraints of the European Union and to reform the European Union from within. And I find that very problematic, because I don't think it's an institution that can be fundamentally reformed. And I think today, more than ever, we should be radically questioning the viability of the European Union. I mean, I think now more than ever, we should be sort of criticized, really fundamentally questioning the viability of this project, because today it's more dangerous than ever. All the economic and democratic problems that I mentioned before are still there, but on top of that, now we have the European Union essentially being one of the prime actors that is trying to drag Europe into this conflict with Russia. In fact, has already dragged Europe into a de facto conflict with Russia, but is trying to now further escalate that, and is the main reason why Europe today cannot seem to be able to free itself from America's grip. And today this is a huge problem. It's a huge problem because it really makes no sense from Europe's standpoint to be to just go along with America in not just war with Russia, but more in general, adopting this very confrontational geopolitical stance vis-a-vis pretty much at this point, I would say, the global majority of people and countries on the planet, which are becoming increasingly assertive and in trying to build an alternative world order, an alternative economic and geopolitical order, and which are tired of the West's bullying. And this would be a great moment for Europe to really free itself, really, from its subordinate and kind of inferior role in this in the Western hierarchy of power, and really try to find its own role in the multipolar world, and which is something that which is what would really bring peace and prosperity to Europe. And instead, we're taking the opposite route and following America down this suicidal confrontational approach to the BRICS, and so it's not just Russia, it's the entire BRICS, and I would say more in general today the global majority. And this I think we're digging our own grave by doing that.
I agree. I was going to bring up BRICS. I think that there's a whole system, they're bringing in a lot of people, including I think Saudi Arabia has signed on or had an interest in joining, as well as multiple countries in Africa. And Africa's had a lot of tumult recently with the coups in Burkina Faso and in Niger and I think Gabon, and they're going more the way of BRICS, I think, because they can be free to still make their own decisions. It's basically a financial union And I've talked to a lot of people in the United States, mostly on the left about it, but also all the people that are establishment tell me BRICS is a dream or a promise, but it's not going to deliver anything. But it seems to be moving at a much faster pace now. It's been going for a few years, but lately it seems like there is an actual light at the end of the tunnel for them. In fact, there's been talk about a digital currency even. Have you heard anything about that? And how would that affect the euro and the dollar?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of the analysis in the West about the BRICS is again a form of cultural projection and a form of a cultural supremacy, to the extent that we analyze what's happening around the world, through our own ideological framework, through our own ideological glasses. And because we tend to think that, we have the best approach to everything, anyone that isn't following the Western approach is seen as failing. So most of the flawed analyses on the BRICS can really be explained in this way. So a lot of analysts in the West, and especially in Europe, they look at the BRICS and they say, oh, but there's no real, formalized structure. There's no, sort of secretary general. There's no boss. There's no, clear hierarchy or institutional division of power. It's nothing like the European Union. And they say that as if that's a bad thing. But when in fact not recognizing that the strength of the BRICS lies precisely in the fact that they haven't gone for some kind of formalized structure, that they haven't gone for a hierarchical structure, that China has not tried to impose itself as the formal or de facto leader of this institution, as, for example, the US clearly is within NATO. In fact, they've kept it as a kind of loose association with based on the voluntary participation of states that can join it, can join it without necessarily having to subscribe to a clear set of rules or structures. Because it's based on the premise that countries should retain their full sovereignty. So it's a very different approach, for example, from the European Union's approach, which was entirely based upon countries having to renounce their sovereignty. BRICS is based on the idea that sovereignty should be the fundamental principle in the organization of the world system. Countries should be sovereign, which means they should be free to choose their own paths of economic development and their own paths in cultural and terms and so on. And this is really a founding principle of the BRICS, but more in general, I would say, of the Chinese approach to international relations. But at the same time, it's based on the understanding that you can have your own sovereignty, but at the same time, you can benefit from engaging economically, diplomatically, politically with other countries. I think that to me sounds like a very healthy approach, and clearly it's proving to be a winning approach, to the extent that the BRICS is not just it's more than just a name. It's more than just a bunch of meetings that are held every year. BRICS is has been a huge engine of economic and infrastructural development in recent years. So to say that BRICS hasn't achieved anything is either ignorant or outright lying, because the BRICS has been a huge engine of development, especially in Africa, you were mentioning, in recent years, because it's based on a model of win-win economic cooperation that a lot of countries find very attractive for obvious reasons. It's a very different approach from the kind of hegemonic predatory approach that the West has pursued and implemented for so long. So it's clear that a lot of countries see it as a superior model of international order. And you were mentioning Saudi Arabia being interested in joining, but or being de facto already a member, and to the extent that it already has extensive economic relations with all the countries of the BRICS, first and foremost China. So the BRICS is already very, very successful. Now, of course, there has been talk for some time for the need to develop also an alternative non-Western financial architecture.
Yeah,
and again, this doesn't mean. So sort of an alternative to SWIFT. And when people often talk of the BRICS currency, I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding there. I mean, it's important to clarify that the BRICS has no intention of creating sort of a monetary union under, like the euro. This is not what the BRICS would want to do, because this would entail essentially, losing for all the membership countries, losing their economic and monetary sovereignty. And that's something that no country wants to do. So when we hear talk of a BRICS currency, we're simply talking of a financial system to facilitate trade and commerce among countries, and this has become increasingly necessary in recent years as the US and Western powers more in general have weaponized the Western financial system, the dollar-based financial system, not just against Russia, but essentially against an incredibly wide range of. I can't remember, but I mean the number of countries that are subject to one form of sanction or another is incredibly long. And it includes also some of the poorest countries in the world. So here we have really a criminal weaponization by the West against of its own financial system, in the sense that they created it against countries who have tended to defy Western foreign policy in the past, so now that's become quite urgent. And as far as I know, and from what I know, it's important steps are being taken in that direction. There's talk of creating, in fact, quite an original kind of blockchain based. System payment system and there are other projects of that sort, and they're moving forward. And in fact, at the recent BRICS conference in Kazan, it was one of the issues that was discussed. So I would imagine that there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes to hasten the rise of this new system. And I think we can expect it to emerge in the near future. I think it's important to note that BRICS countries have already been able, to a large degree, to bypass the Western financial system simply by trading in their own currencies. What they want to try to build now is a system that also, is able to compensate for trade imbalances between countries. Sort of kind of what the IMF was supposed to do when it was born, before it became just a tool of financial blackmail against developing countries by the West and the US. So that's what they want to build, but. It's important to note that they've already, to a large degree, managed to extricate themselves from the Western financial system. And this is, of course, why Russia has been able to withstand the sanctions so successfully, and in fact is today growing at quite a healthy rate, as opposed to the countries of the European Union, most of which are in near recession or in outright deindustrialization. So I think really this points to just the declining power and influence of the kind of Western-led global hegemonic order. It doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't exist in economic terms anymore. It doesn't exist, I would say, in cultural and soft power terms, because in fact we see the countries of the global South or the global majority being more mad at the West than ever before for the way it's behaving, and for just its atrocious approach to several conflicts, not just Ukraine, but of course even more so what's happening in Gaza and the Middle East more in general. All it has left is a huge amount of raw military power and thousands of nuclear weapons, but of course that's not that's in itself not enough to rule the world, because you can destroy the world, but arguably that's kind of self-defeating as well. So really, I think it's we are really witnessing the kind of the end stages of 500 years of Western global hegemony, of Western global supremacy, and a lot of the chaos and violence that we're witnessing around the world is America's and the West's more in general kind of desperate reaction to this. They're engaged in some increasingly desperate attempts to prevent the inevitable from happening, and in fact from preventing what has already happened to simply consolidate and solidify into a new global architecture of power. And I think the strategy they're adopting is a strategy of chaos. Let's just create as much chaos as possible as a way of slowing down, halting, or ideally reversing this process of multipolarization and decline of Western dominance. But of course, it can't work in the medium term. And it's proving to be incredibly destructive in the short term. I think a lot of what we're witnessing in the Middle East is simply a microcosm of this of what is happening on a wider scale, to the extent that Israel is an extension of Western power in the Middle East. And so that's what we're witnessing is their own desperate reaction to what they feel is a window that is closing in terms of the global balance of power. And so they'll try to take as much as they can before this window closes. And they'll try to create as much havoc and destruction before this window closes. But I think it's what the US is is doing more in general on a global scale in Ukraine. And it's what it's sort of laying the ground for in the Asia Pacific as well. It's really quite incredible what they're doing. But I think Biden's announcement, it's part of this strategy of chaos, I think, which of course isn't just incredibly destructive, for the people at the receiving end of our violence, but it's also incredibly dangerous for the citizens of the West. And I think this is really something that we that a lot of people really underestimate. Otherwise, we'd have millions of people marching in the streets against what's happening, but we're not seeing any of that. So I think there's a radical underappreciation of just how dangerous the situation is, even for us in the West.
Yes, for sure. Well, we're coming up on an hour. I want to thank you so much. We had a little bit of video breakup a couple of times, but the audio was fine the entire time. So that's what's most important. This is fascinating, and I hope you can come on again sometime. I really enjoyed it, and I have so many more questions. Everything you say brings up another question for me. But I know that.
Sorry, you should have stopped me. I just start to ramble, you know. So you.
Should, I love it.
You should have stopped me.
It was wonderful. Okay. Yeah.
Next time, you know. Next time, feel free to stop me whenever you want, because I'll just go on talking for forever.
Oh, I think it's wonderful, and I agree with everything that you're saying. And I meant to bring up also that, you know, basically the reason that the dollar we went off the dollar. The gold standard back in the 70s was for oil because of Saudi Arabia, and now they're still going away from us. So yeah, a lot of people say that we're kind of in the times of the end of the Roman Empire is what a lot of people are comparing it to. Where can people find you on the internet? Where can people find your writings, Thomas?
So these days I mostly write on X. As most of us do, on that crazy place that is X. And I've got my Substack at thomasfassi.com, where I publish a lot of original stuff, as well as publishing all the articles that I publish for the publications that I work for, which these days is mainly Unheard, which is a British publication, and Compact, which is an American publication. And I would recommend everyone to go and check them out. I think they're two great alternative mags that offer a very good alternative to the mainstream. And that's pretty much it. But by signing up to my Substack, people can be up to date with everything I'm doing, and the interviews or whatever. So it's all archived there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, and I definitely want to have you on again. This is going to be an interesting year, and I think a lot of things are popping off. So thank you so much, and thank you to our listeners, and we will see you next time.